turn it over, and Bob, it's all yours.
Thank you, David. Good morning, everybody. I finally got my notes to print this morning. I had this on my iPad up until last night because my printer wouldn't work at home, and I was going to walk around with an iPad trying to be like Tyler Morris or Blake Dumé, you know, a cool young millennial. But I did get my notes to print, which is a good thing. For the past several weeks, Pastor Mark has covered what he called the big story. For those that have been here, taking a look at the foundations of our faith. Mark started with God's perfect creation, our rebellion, and then God's saving grace through Jesus Christ. My favorite definition of grace is undeserved favor. Simple definition. God gave us undeserved favor in making a way back to him through Jesus Christ. The main purpose of the big story that Mark has been covering was to provide a biblical framework for viewing the world. As a church, we wanted to make sure that essentially we were all on the same page here, at least in this early service, before moving on to some more focused studies on things like evangelism, which is what Mark is going to start talking about next week and continue for 3 weeks through the month of November. So this week is something a little bit different. Can anybody tell me what happens on Tuesday? What's that? The election. Yeah, hopefully everyone is going to the polls, or you've already voted absentee. And it kind of brings up a question. So we'll call this your special pre-election issue here, sort of in between other topics. What should be the Christian's involvement in politics or public policy or the public square? What do you think?
Vote our values.
Okay, good answer. Anybody else? I know there's some opinions on this out here because I've talked to a bunch of you guys about this. So give me at least one more. Complete. Okay. Okay. Any others? Pray for our leaders. Excellent. Okay. Well, I would suggest to you that sometimes in the evangelical church, we get a couple of different views on this question, and I wanted to kind of articulate them for you. The first one kind of goes like this. If we could just get our guy into there, I'm looking at the screen in back, if we could get our guy into that house, right? If we could get our people into the halls of Congress, if we could get our people appointed to the justices of the Supreme Court or judges in our appellate courts, if we could just take control again, then everything would be all right. It would be the sweet land of liberty once again, and we'd stick it to those Hollywood liberals, and we'd see the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. Glory, glory, hallelujah, and can I get an amen? All right. So thank you for the amen, but I'm not sure that that's exactly a biblical vision. There's another one that kind of goes like this, and pay no mind to the fact I might be standing on the right or the left side of the stage here. Seriously, it kind of goes like this. Man, it is bad out there. Our culture is toxic. It is evil. I don't want to be tainted by this. I don't want my family tainted by this. In a generation or two, it has really fallen apart. And thus, I am going to hunker down in my Christian bunker with my Christian friends and my Christian music and my Christian subculture, and I'm going to take a page out of the Mormon playbook and stockpile the canned food and the ammunition, and I'm just going to wait it out because Jesus has got to be coming back like tomorrow. He can't allow this to go on much longer, right? There's wars and rumors of wars and stuff's happening in the Middle East and natural disasters, and I'm just going to wait it out and I'm not going to be poisoned by this culture, all right? So that's another view that we sometimes get. It's yucky out there and I don't want to touch it. And so is that a biblical view? I mean, after all, in Psalm 24, it says the earth is the Lord's and everything in it except the culture and the politics and the public square, right? No, it says the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, period. 4 million evangelical Christians did not vote in the last presidential election. Perhaps they didn't like either candidate. Perhaps some thought that, you know, what goes on sort of in the outside world there is really none of our concern or not important to us. And I realized that in painting those two pictures, I kind of made it a little cartoonish, a little exaggeration. And I did that on purpose. I do think there's a little bit of truth in both of those, right? We do need to protect ourselves a little bit from the culture. And there is something to be said for the fact that our judicial system, our laws, did rise from Judeo-Christian beliefs and values. But let's just sort of bookmark this discussion and come to this. We often these days hear the expression, the separation of church and state, right? A phrase that Thomas Jefferson had used in a fairly obscure letter that no one had heard of until 1947, when the Supreme Court used the phrase in a court decision. It's now become very much a part of our culture. This is the same Jefferson who funded, using taxpayer dollars, Christian missionaries to go to the Indians and other nations and set up Christian schools. And the phrase is often used in the opposite way that Jefferson intended it. But we could ask another question from this, and this will be a rhetorical one, but what does God have to say about the separation of church and state? We discussed this in Cornerstone a couple of years ago, and I know a number of you are Cornerstone alums or Stoneheads out here. And David also covered this in his sermon to an extent on June 22nd, I think it was, when he talked about Romans 13 and the Christian's duty to the state and the role of the state. So I don't want to go a lot into detail here, except to say that there are those out there in our society who believe that we can progress toward kind of a utopia, kind of a perfect society. And as Christians, we know that that's not the case. We cannot do that. We can't perfect society because of sin, right? God will perfect it at some point in time in the future, but we can't do that now. So God gives us a model, though, for a functional society. He assigns roles, or you might call it jurisdiction, to different institutions and says, this is what I'm empowering them to do. And God uses these institutions to sort of curb the power of sin and keep society, keep the world from spinning completely out of control. You can see some of them up on the screen. I won't read them, but the church, for example, is responsible for discipling, making disciples of all nations, not just believers, but disciples. One reason that we're here this morning, one reason that we changed up what we do at Cedar Run a little bit, is to provide a more robust discipling experience on Sunday morning. And hopefully many of you are taking advantage of that, and you're here, and you're also going to be in the second service this morning. But Satan wants evil and chaos to reign, right? One way he does that is to attack the institutions that God has authorized, corrupting them so that they no longer do their mission. He attacks their jurisdiction, if you will, and they get out of their lane. There are a number of examples of this, and I won't spend time on that because I could be here all day, but just a couple. You know, in the Middle Ages, the church was raising armies and sending them off to war and holding criminal trials, which resulted in sometimes in people being imprisoned or even capital punishment. I don't think that's the role of the church. That's a role that belongs to the state. The state bears the sword, not the church. One other example. The Bible, 205 times, depending on your translation, mentions the poor. Many of those mentions are admonitions to help the poor. How many times do you think that instruction to help the poor is given to the state or to the government out of 205 times? None? Zero? Actually, I find two references. One is in Proverbs 28, where it says the king should not oppress the poor, and the other is in Exodus 23, when it says the state must not deny the poor access to the courts, access to the judicial system. Every other mention of the poor, every other instruction to help the poor is given to one of these other institutions. In Matthew 25, when Jesus is talking about feeding the hungry, he's not turning toward Rome and saying, Caesar, help the hungry, or to the Roman governor. He's talking to his disciples, who are collectively called what? The church, right? So just a couple of examples. The state or the government today we see taking the lead on a lot of social justice issues, which traditionally have belonged to other institutions. And if that's right, if the state really isn't supposed to be doing that, then the question I would ask is whether the system is bound to fail if that continues. And I'm not going to try to answer that question for you this morning, but believe it's worth considering as we talk about how to impact the culture around us, is exactly what are we supposed to do? And what are the other institutions supposed to do? And we need to be thinking biblically about who's supposed to be doing what. All right, let's talk about the state of the church in America right now. The president said a couple of years ago, I think, something to the effect that whatever we once were no longer a Christian nation. And I don't want to debate that, but I will say that I think it's safe to say that America was once part of what we would call Christendom, meaning that Christianity and Judeo-Christian values and standards were sort of the norm. For about 150 years, they were built into the fabric of our institutions, schools, universities, civic and children's organizations, the legal system, and into our government to an extent. Meetings of all kinds opened in prayer. Faith messages were written into the charters of civic organizations. You really don't have to go too far into our founding documents to find we were endowed by our Creator, to find references to God. And despite attempts to sort of paint them differently, it would be hard to argue with the fact that about 95% of our founders are what we would consider Orthodox Christians in terms of their belief systems. I thought about throwing a whole bunch of quotes from the founders out here this morning, but I decided not to do that, and I just picked one, not from a founder, but from the president of Westminster Theological Seminary today, Peter Lilleback, who's written a book called George Washington's Sacred Fire, in which he looks at 100 prayers that George Washington actually wrote himself. But it says, as you can see, the logic of our founders went something like this. Do you want to be free? Then you need a republic. But a republic doesn't work unless you have a moral people. And to have a moral people, you need religious teaching. One other just fun example for you. Don't shout it out, but how many of you recognize the lyrics to this song? How many of you could name this song if I asked you to? Lee knows. So let me, it's kind of a trick question. Let me show you a different verse of this song and you tell me if you recognize it. This is your national anthem. And it didn't get, well, it was written by Francis Scott Key, but it didn't become our national anthem until the 1930s. So not all that long ago in history, right? So where are we today? We've all seen the statistics on sort of the rise of the nuns, if you will, people that, nuns meaning N-O-N-E-S, people that don't have a religion, don't believe in anything. And with people in the sort of the millennial generation and younger, it's a huge percentage. So what is the interaction with the church? Well, there are kind of two that I'll mention. One is sort of an indifference or a disconnectedness. I have the the front cover of the Left Behind, the first Left Behind book up here. Before the movie with Nicolas Cage, which just came out, how many of you were familiar with these books or with this series? Almost everybody in the room. Not saying that we necessarily agree with the eschatology or that we think they're well-written books, but in the church, this was a phenomenon, right? 65 million copies sold, one of the best sellers of the 20th century. When it went up against Harry Potter in the late 90s and early 2000s, it beat some of the Harry Potter books. Everybody in the church knows about this. Yet, in the early 2000s, Pew or Barna, I can't remember which, did a survey of kind of cultural elites. University professors, journalists, lawyers, and asked about these books, asked their opinion. And what do you think the answer was most commonly? What's that? They were like, what are you talking about? It wasn't hostile. It was, what are you talking about? They had never, so something that's a cultural phenomenon in the church that everybody knows about, the cultural elites in our society had never even heard of, by and large. And I mean, a huge majority of them had never even heard of it. And I just use that as a point to illustrate that where the culture is, where the cultural elites are in the United States, and where we are as evangelical Christians, we don't cross over much anymore. It's not the way it used to be when, if we go back a few decades, when essentially most Christians were the cultural elites. Not so anymore. One other example closer to home. My son Jack just finished playing fall baseball. And the, getting some music behind me. I like it, but the coach, who was a real gentleman, great coach, nice guy, started scheduling practices on Sunday morning. And I don't mean like late on Sunday morning. I mean kind of like right in the heart of Sunday morning, 9 to 11. And so I went to him and I said, and it was an additional practice. We had a practice during the week as well, but I went to the coach and I said, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, we go to church on Sunday morning and Jack's not going to be able to make those Sunday morning practices. And the coach wasn't hostile to me. He didn't get up in my face. He literally was just sort of dumbfounded by that. He was like, oh. it just didn't strike him that somebody might have something to do on Sunday morning. To him, it was the one time during the week where there was really nothing going on except maybe people sleeping in, kids sleeping in. And so he thought, hey, that's a great time to schedule baseball practice. Again, just another example of sort of there's this indifference or sort of disconnectedness between us and the culture out there. It wasn't hostile. It was just kind of a question mark. But there also is hostility. The New Mexico Supreme Court recently decided a case regarding a photographer who refused to take photographs of a homosexual wedding. And I read this decision, and what I'm quoting up here is from a concurring opinion. One of the justices or judges in the New Mexico Supreme Court concurred with this decision. And I give this judge a lot of credit for saying something honestly that a lot of them won't say. And he said this: the defendants, the photographer, now are compelled by law to compromise the very religious beliefs that inspire their lives. And then adding, and I had not seen this before in a judicial decision, that is the price of citizenship. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this. And essentially what they're saying is that rights that were once sacrosanct at the top of the pyramid, right, First Amendment stuff, freedom of religion, now they haven't gone away. I mean, we're still free to be here this morning, right, but they're taking a back seat to certain other things. In this case, it's sexual freedom. I've not seen that before in a decision. And again, I credit this guy with being honest about where they're going. From this week, there's a colonel in the Ohio Air National Guard who wrote a column for his unit's newsletter. It's no longer in his unit's newsletter because as soon as it was published, there was such an outcry. And when I say such an outcry, it probably was about three people. But nonetheless, he was forced to pull this. And essentially, what he didn't proselytize. All he said was, I am who I am today. My success is due to the fact that of my mother's faith. And my mother's faith translated to me, I became a believer, and Jesus Christ has seen me through real tough times in my life. That's what the article basically says, and it's no longer published. And there are some, I don't think this will happen, that are calling for the colonel to be disciplined. What will happen with his career because of this, I'm not sure, but it's an example. I was going to show you a video at this point, and I decided not to do it for time, but there's a couple in Oregon who owned a bakery. They've since lost their business. And very similar to the New Mexico case, they refused to provide services for a homosexual wedding. And they're now facing... they've lost their business, they're probably losing their house, and they're facing $100,000 plus in fines. And if you look at them, they don't look like an old, stodgy, conservative guy like Pastor Morris, as they say, like me. They're young. The guy's got a couple earrings. The gal's got a couple of tattoos. I mean, they're young, they're hip, they're sort of with it. They don't hate anybody. But they just said, this violates our conscience, and we're not going to do it. And they're facing the consequences. When we were in charge, when Christians were in charge, more or less, we might have made things uncomfortable for non-believers from time to time, but we never forced our religion on anybody because the tenets of our faith say that doesn't work, you can't do that. But the secularists are going to have no problem trying to force their religion on us, and we should be prepared for that. The way somebody put this to me recently, it was actually, I don't think Rick Beckwith is here, but he introduced me to a guy by the name of Mike Metzger, who's a Christian writer, and he put it this way. He said, if you look at the original definition of the word pagan, it meant somebody outside of the city and outside of the culture, right? It took on other meanings over time, but that was the original meaning. And if we use that meaning, who are the pagans in America today? It's us. David's never going to let me get up here and speak it. He says, you just called the congregation a bunch of pagans. So what should be our response to this? I would suggest that there are three. And the first one is the one I'm going to spend the most time on. And it is this: to be salt and light. Matthew 5, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Let your light shine before others, verse 16, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. It's a directive to the church, but it's also a directive to each one of us. Lee, Dan, you're to be the salt of the earth. the light of the world. Before refrigeration, salt was used for preservative and antiseptic purposes, right? Not just for flavor enhancement. Jesus, when he was a little boy, and I got to pause when I say something, I think about the God of the universe was once a little boy, right? Jesus would have seen Mary rub salt into meat. And we think of that today, again, mostly for flavor, but the main function was to keep perishable food from decaying. John Stott, theologian, longtime pastor, the late John Stott wrote this. The notion is not that the world is tasteless and that Christians can make it less insipid, but that it is putrefying. It cannot stop itself from going bad. Only salt introduced from the outside can do this. The church is set in the world as salt to arrest or at least hinder the process of social decay. God intends the most powerful of all restraints within sinful society to be his own redeemed, regenerate, and righteous people. You are the light of the world. If this room were completely dark and someone lit a candle, we'd start to be able to see. If all of us lit candles, like we'll do on Christmas Eve, I assume, it gets pretty bright. That's the idea. Each candle dispels darkness. Christians must penetrate non-Christian society, and although distinct, we are not to be socially segregated. A lamp does no good if hidden away in a bunker. The light must shine into darkness, and the salt must soak into the meat. I love Advent. Advent season's coming up. Christmas is coming up. I love the music. I love the song Silent Night. But I have a little bit of a problem with that song because I don't think Jesus coming into the world was Silent Night. I think it was D-Day. I think it was the invasion of enemy territory, starting to reconquer territory from the enemy, and we're to carry on that fight today. Where there is no light, or the light is afraid to shine, as David mentioned in his sermon back in June, evil prevails. If the church does not shine its light and prevent the decay, who will? Some examples. In 252 AD, the Christians of Corinth saved the city from the plague by responding to the needs of those who were simply dragged into the street and left. Early Christians stood in opposition to infanticide, the degradation of women, to the gladiator games, to slavery, you name it. More recently in history, Christians were responsible for the ideas that the mentally ill should be cared for, not simply discarded, that children should be educated, that women have dignity, that the slave trade would end in the United Kingdom and throughout Europe, the abolitionist movement in the United States, the first hospitals, the first universities in Europe and the United States, the Bill of Rights, the fight against sex trafficking and slavery today, the idea that each individual has dignity being made in the image of God, ending the abortion epidemic in the United States. Wait a minute, you say we haven't done that. Yeah, we did. The last one, the one that occurred after the Civil War, where abortion occurred at about the same rate as it's occurring today, but by 1900 had virtually disappeared. Prison reform, child labor reform, all Christian ideas. Nursing, Florence Nightingale was trained in a missionary school. Henry Durant, student evangelist, founded the Red Cross. Preacher William Booth founded the Salvation Army. The Christian Missionary Society taught 200,000 people in West Africa to read in one generation. Wait a minute, I thought the government was responsible for educating children. Missionaries have secured the abolition of widow burning and child sacrifice in tribal cultures, brought medicine to the world, World Vision, Compassion International, International Justice Mission, focus on the family's foster care adoption project. We have 500,000 children in foster care in the United States today. About half of them will never be adopted nor return to their own birth families. They're too old to be adopted. They age out of the system, which means that when they turn 18, they will move from being institutionalized in that system to being institutionalized in another system, and it's called prison. It's just the facts. It's the statistics. Unless somebody does something about it. And Focus on the Family, partnering with a whole bunch of churches, is doing something about it, trying to educate people across the country on how to adopt older children. I could go on and on about this. Cal Covert in Nicaragua, Carly Beckwith in Washington, D.C., our new commandment guys here locally, Heather White going off to some godforsaken place, except it's not godforsaken, right? Because she's there. And yes, our Christian public policymakers and politicians, like outgoing Congressman Frank Wolf, who attempt to bring light and salt to the halls of Congress, to the National Security Council, to our courtrooms. All right, how do we do this? How do we be salt and light? One piece of advice from Colossians 4. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation always be full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. Let me show you something real quick. This person has been in the news, Brittany Maynard. She was planning to die yesterday. I think she decided to wait. She moved to Oregon. She has inoperable brain cancer to take advantage. She went there to take advantage of the suicide law there. By the way, talking about the jurisdictional issue from the beginning, I find nowhere in the Bible where an individual, and this is a hard question, but an individual is authorized to take human life, including their own. But nonetheless, I don't want to talk about her so much as how people responded to it. I read an article about her about a month ago, and something just struck me in the comments. I like to read the comments to articles these days because I think it gives us an idea of where the culture is. And I went out for a run after reading this, and I stopped halfway and came back to find it again and write it down because I thought it was so telling. This person, Deborah, you see her comment up there. She comments to this news article. She blogs at a place called Informing Christians. And you get to the bottom. I wish someone would tell her she does not have to kill herself. This is very sad in so many ways. But the first part is, nothing is said about her faith in God, meaning Brittany Maynard. I assume she does not believe on Jesus Christ. Okay, so here's a Christian commenting. I think it's an okay comment. Then, of course, you see what you often see. The next person comes back. You are a brainwashed Jesus freak. You see that a lot. Deborah comes back. Scott, I'm actually heartwashed by Jesus Christ. I thought that was a pretty witty response. But Deborah doesn't stop there. This is her full response. I'm heartwashed by Jesus Christ, and now I'm going to call you a name. Does that work? So the next comment, someone who's clearly not a believer, picks up on the fact that Deborah is a hypocrite. Anyway, if your fake savior did exist, I do believe the freak remark you made is one more black mark on your Jesus record. How often do we do that or something like it in our conversations? Are our words full of grace and seasoned with salt? Here's a better example, a good example. Many of you are familiar with what's going on in Houston, Texas, where the city of Houston has subpoenaed the sermons and the talks from various pastors on the subject of homosexuality. They've since withdrawn the subpoena. But this is part of an email that went out from Grace International Churches, one of the organizations involved. And look at this advice. Watch your words as a believer. Don't badger or denigrate the Houston mayor. Pray for her and those under her. We need to be careful of the words that come out of our mouths concerning her. She is a civil authority. Remember that jurisdiction thing. With even if we disagree very, very strongly with her, Pastor Steve has continually spoken with firmness, restraint, and civility. It is easy to be drawn into an ugly war of words since supporters on the other side say unprintable things about anyone holding biblical views. How's that for advice? I like Stu a lot better than Deborah. So I said there are three things, and salt and light was the first of those, and you're probably getting a little worried because David's like looking at his watch going, how's he going to cover two more? And I'm not. I'm going to just mention them briefly because we're going to cover them in upcoming weeks. The second one, I thought I had another slide there. So the second one essentially is this. Inject the gospel, inject Jesus Christ into culture. Be salt and light in what we do. Inject Jesus Christ into culture. And we can do this one person at a time. And that's called evangelism. And Mark Seeger is going to cover that in the next three Sundays right here at 9:15 in the morning. So please come back for that. And then finally, got me? All right. Sorry about that. We jumped ahead. Finally, pray. It should be slide 30. So along with evangelism, maybe we should have talked about prayer first. Along with evangelism, prayer is one of the other major areas of emphasis over the next year at Cedar Run. And you'll be hearing more about that. But be salt and light in our culture. Inject the gospel through evangelism and pray. We don't have to defeat culture. We don't have to do anything negative, but something positive. I tend to pray for things that are close to me, things in my life, and God tells us to do that. Bring all of your concerns before him. But along with praying for Aunt Matilda's ingrown toenail, we should include the nation and the church. How about the entertainment industry? How about our politicians? How about the culture? Are we doing that? Are we praying for them? The Bible says in 2 Chronicles, if my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, and will heal their land. So too often, in conclusion, we just take our ball and go home. I know I'm inclined to do this. We hunker down in our Christian bunker or our Christian ghetto, shrugging our shoulders and saying, God's will be done. And of course, we'll just do our Christian thing in our Christian subculture. And of course, God's will be done, but we are often the instruments, or I could even say always, the instruments that he uses to do it. If the church does not identify and engage evil, if the church is not involved in culture, if the church isn't trying to be salt and light, then who will? Hollywood? The Chamber of Commerce? Wall Street? Our hallowed, ivy-covered academic institutions? The judiciary? Who? There really isn't anybody but the church who can do this. The good news is that Christians can change culture. The bad news is that sometimes it can take a long time. We don't always get instant gratification. It took 300 years for the church to entirely change the Roman Empire, but the world was never the same. It doesn't always take that long. We have a history in this country of renewals that have happened a number of times and great awakenings that have happened several times, but it can take a long time. I'll leave you with this quote. And I was going to ask you who said it, but I think you might have figured that out when we jumped ahead. But the church must be reminded that it is not the master or the servant of the state, but rather the conscience of the state. It must be the guide and the critic of the state and never its tool. If the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority. And I was going to ask who said that and was hoping that somebody would answer incorrectly, you know, John Adams or something like that. But it was actually much more recently in history. It was Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s. Be salt and light in our culture. Inject the gospel wherever you can through evangelism and pray. Pray for our leaders, pray for our culture, and pray for our country. And vote on Tuesday.